Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
We take a call from our listener, Mike Wagner.
And man, was his voice dry.
That's really well done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like it.
Okay, so recently, this refers to when we were just talking about Kid Brother recently. We had a very special guest in the Washington, D.C.
We did.
Area,
it was
right?
Amazing.
Where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Some guy from Texas came and visited us, right?
Loser.
You might hear his voice in the background.
Yeah.
Oh, is he listening?
Is that my conscience?
So, so we were really happy to have one of our listeners, Mike Wagner from Houston, Texas. You've heard him on the show before as a guest host. He's done some guest host episodes for us that people really liked. And he's just been a great supporter of the show for a long time. And when we heard he was going to come up to the D.C. area, mainly to see us, but also I think to visit his daughter or something. I don't know. That was kind of secondary.
Whatever.
Mainly to see
that
us.
That is the correct order.
Yeah. We scheduled the Kid Brother show at the Greg Wilson house specifically to be on that weekend so Mike could come and partake in that, right?
Amazing. Yeah.
So now we have him here on the phone line because he's one of our podcast patrons.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And anyone who wants to do that can go to patreon.com/suburbspod and you can see all the ways that you can help support the show there. But one of the ways is perks of that is that you get to be on the show and you get to pick a topic and you get to be on from time to time. And Mike is one of those folks. And so welcome via phone this time, Mike Wagner.
Hello, gents.
And we didn't introduce ourselves.
No,
right?
We did not.
Nope.
So I'm Sam Lisker.
Here on The Rock in the Suburbs, I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Sam Lisker.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
Thank you.
All right, maybe. And then and so, Mike, what did you want to talk about on this very special episode?
What I thought we would discuss, what I found interesting, and actually, if you remember, I asked Kid Brother kind of about this very question because I always find it interesting. And it was is about the role of mixing and how recording happens and the effect that it has on an album. And the reason I thought of it was because the Replacements re-released Don't Tell a Soul, and they went back to the tape. They found the original tapes. Chrissy Dunlop, Slim's wife, found the tapes, and they went back and they remixed it by the original producer. It wasn't done by the mixer that they specifically got, who was sort of a hotshot mixer at the time. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's
totally
a great
makes
topic.
Sense. Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to start with is I thought I saw you make a comment, Jim, that you thought the albums had a certain, I'll let you speak to that.
I'll give you my point of view, and I know that a lot of people don't have this point of view, but mm-hmm. that's okay. But let me just start by saying the whole idea of remixes, right? So, you've done a little bit of recording yourself, Mike. I mean, you've got stuff up on the streamings, right? You want to plug that real quick?
My band is Total Strangers, and we recorded an album a couple years back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you record, I mean, I think people understand this, in a studio, hardly anybody these days like records with like everybody playing at the same time. That's a real rarity, right?
Yeah.
Correct.
So you tend to record different parts separately on separate tracks, and then there's a point in the process where you mix the tracks and you can turn up, you know, more guitar.
Yeah.
You can turn down the Bish's drums, right? You can, different stuff with EQ and, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. how, they get mm-hmm. into things like double tracking and stuff like that, right? I mean, there's all kinds of studio tricks that you can do in the mixing process,
absolutely.
Right?
Yep.
And if you took two different guys with the same tracks and ask them to mix an album, it probably would sound two different ways, right?
It is actually quite different. It's more than you think.
Right, because there's a lot you could do with it, and a lot of different ways it might hit the ear.
Right,
different
totally
people.
Totally. And Mike, let me ask you this question. So I think about this from a couple perspectives. One, if you're a band like, let's say, Wingtip Slope, and you
never
set
heard
up,
of them,
and you set up your recording equipment in a basement, and the way you do your band is that you do it as a hobby and you go over and you play. And when you record, you just get lucky. But in getting lucky, Mike, the live recording tends to be good. So there is so much bleed between our instruments. Like, you could never mix the drums or never mix the guitar or the bass, right? Because it's everywhere. So it's all, you know, as much balance as you can get. But let's think about when a band has a big studio budget. They go in, everything's isolated, right?
Right.
They have, you know, they might even be in a separate room, or the vocals are recorded, or you might even splice together five bass takes just to get the one bass track. So do you think, Mike, that mixing and post-production is necessarily a product of environment, or is it always going to be something where if you're a great mixer, you can get something out of even a live recording, you know, like Wingtip Slope?
I really think that there is a skill and a that is required to mix.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like making eggs. Everybody can crack two eggs.
Exactly.
But only certain people can make souffles.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that, like, you'll take a song like, the one I always think about is off Exile on Main Street. If you take a song like Tumbling Dice,
yep,
that sounds like it was done in one take.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually like tons and tons and tons and tons of takes. It's like, I think it was over like 100 takes.
Right.
Oof, by the time they were done.
Right.
And they had to sort of work it all together to make it sound, and it sounds live, right? When you hear it, you go, oh, that was one take.
Totally.
Right? Clearly, because it's so effortless. But it was like, but then you have other songs that are legit one take things, and there's not much to do, right? Because when the Beatles did Twist and Shout, it was literally one take and that was it,
right?
There was really nothing to do. So I think, but that being said, I do think there is a huge skill there. And I think somebody with that skill can make it sound really, really good. Where somebody without it, it'll sound bland,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Is that your feeling as well? Or what do you guys think?
That makes sense. I mean, I think there's always something to be caressed from, you know, a certain way if you had certain files and you could, you know, turn things up and down. But I do think, you know, happenstance plays a part, and I think also planning plays a part. You know, if you take the replacements, we're going to go in a big studio, we're on a big label, and we're going to have everything there available, right?
Right.
And yep. So you can massage it.
Right. So in 1989,
yep.
Right, the replacements recorded Don't Tell a Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And the fans did the longtime fans of the band did not have a great reaction to that album.
No, they did not.
And a lot of it was because the production of it, right? They
felt
correct. it was too slick, too polished, like too like sort of big 80s sounding. Then they weren't used to that. That's not how they wanted the Replacements to sound. They wanted to be more stripped down and raw and quirky and weird and all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, now, interestingly, that was their best-selling album. So, mm-hmm. so what? Maybe not as good as selling as the as Psy Records,
right?
May have hoped, but the point is, the general public did respond well to that album, and then partly because it had like one big hit single, which was "I'll Be You."
Right. Yeah.
But that may have not gotten that much radio play, maybe without that production, right? Yeah. I don't know, right? Yeah. It's sort of radio ready, you know?
Right.
But anyway, all these years later, where are we now? 30 years later.
That's right.
I have that right.
Mm-hmm.
They release a box set extended version where they, now, I think what they did was, didn't they go back to or work on basically kind of restoring an earlier mix that had happened?
Yeah,
right?
That was my question.
I'm happy to be corrected here, but what I think it was the original tapes from the Bearsville sessions. Right? There was tapes from the Bearsville sessions, which was done prior to them going to LA, where they recorded primarily all of the album. And I think there were some Bearsville takes, which were, they sound more like demos,
yes,
more than they sound like finished tracks.
Yeah, but that's not
and
one.
Then there was the ones from LA's, which I think Matt Wallace, who was the original producer,
right,
went back and remixed.
Right, but my understanding is that he kind of restored it back to the way he originally had it mixed at the time.
Correct.
Before then, they brought in somebody else to,
correct,
radio it up. Right. So
right, they brought in Chris Lord Alge or something like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, something
really
like
knows
that.
Name.
So anyway, the point I made, I gave those songs a listen. Well, some of them on Spotify. I didn't buy this set. And the point I made on Facebook was, I kind of like the Bearsville stuff because that was more, like you said, more like demos, and it sounded like a different take on the songs, you know. And that was, I was fine with that. It just kind of felt more like a raw version of,
right,
the songs.
Right.
But they
kind of like the Beatles anthology more, so
yeah,
more or less.
But the actual songs released, but the actual tracks that they released, just sort of as, and then mixed a different way from what I'm used to hearing, I did not like that. And it's,
right,
not that I didn't,
right,
think they were better. They might have been better. I don't really make a judgment on whether they're better or worse. My feeling was just like, it's not how I remember it. It's not how I have it in my head. And whether or not you like all the, you know, the slick production or whatever, the reality is, to me, it's sort of like a, I don't know, it's like a document or a great novel or something, mm-hmm, like that. It's published. It's out there. It's not only about the content itself, but it's also sort of a reflection of its time in some way. And so my feeling was that you're sort of, you're changing history in some way. You're sort of doing it over. You're trying to change what had already, a piece of work that had already been put out there.
Yeah,
right.
Totally.
And I just didn't like it. And so, mm-hmm, I think I listened to about four of those, mm-hmm, songs, and, mm-hmm, then I was like, I'm done. I don't really want this. Cause I want my memory to remain of that album, good, bad, or whatever, the way I remember it.
That's,
you,
right,
know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important, Jim. I mean, you make decisions in the moment that seem to be,
right,
the decisions,
right,
you have to make. And
that's
when,
right,
you're in a band, you have to say, all right, this is it. I don't want to go the other way. Let's do this. And you do that, and that's what you live with. But, yeah, you could go back and, revise a lot of stuff. But one thing I wanted to ask Mike, you know, being someone who's mixed a record, what is the process? What do you do? Do you turn everything down and like slowly start turning the drums up like one at a time? Like, how do you mix a record? I don't really know.
Okay. So like when I did it, it was, Hunt and Peck.
Okay.
Like, I mean, I had never done it before. And I literally actually watched some YouTube videos and, uh-huh, stuff. And then, you know,
So you had all the files like on Pro Tools?
Okay,
or?
so to answer your question, so like usually what you do, so like for us, what we did is we had I would play a raw, just like a guitar track with a click track,
right?
And then we recorded all the drums, and then we recorded the bass on top of that.
Okay,
and then I would overdub the guitars again, And then we would do the vocals and then anything else that would be you would want to add, like little keyboard bits or then you do the leads after that or whatever it might be.
So you've got totally clean, separate tracks for everything.
Totally clean. Okay. In our case, that's what it was. It was all totally clean.
Got it.
Because we were all in different places, so we had to record it over it was not an option to all go into the studio and record it one time.
Right. Which is cool though. Right. I mean, that's a cool way to do it if you can do it that way. Yeah.
Right. And then actually that's how like a lot of albums are recorded.
Totally.
I mean, nowadays in particular, because it's for whatever reason, you know. And so and one thing I think people should understand, because a lot of times you'll hear like they're going to remaster something, which is actually different than remixing.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
So like in the remixing, they went back to the tapes and they said, well, these guitars need to be louder and the vocals are too low, and so they might raise them, or they might add reverb to a vocal, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Take off that double track guitar, right? And just leave the single guitar or whatever, right?
Right. And I think that's like, that was sort of Paul Westerberg's biggest gripe, was they put what he would call goop on it, right? Mm-hmm. And they would be like, and if you listen to a lot of his stuff, he doesn't seem to like a lot of reverb-y stuff, right?
Totally.
And, right.
His vocals, he likes his vocals dry. Dry meaning there's no reverb.
Right.
And then wetness means typically, if somebody who knows better, feel free to correct me, but he didn't like a lot of reverb, and I think that's probably the biggest complaint he had about it was that you know there's a lot of reverb on the vocals in particular, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I like the replacements. There was no reverb on the vocals. It sounded good.
Which is funny because I like give it. I love that stuff.
Yeah,
I mean I never really had a problem with the production on Don't Tell a Song.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, but then again, there's also, I think it's like what Jim was saying, Don't Tell a Soul is my entry point into the replacements as well, right? Mm-hmm. So right. I think it depends on like if I had been there from the beginning and then I heard that, I might have had that reaction.
Right. So now you have an emotional context that you have to deal with. Yep.
Like Face Dances is not the best Who's album. Who album?
No.
But that was my entry point, right? Yeah, so there's always that little... Right?
Yep.
And like when I hear It's Hard, I'm like, oh my God, that's just not very good. You know what I mean?
Right. Even though you saw the tour and you had a lot of fun on that tour. So you have an emotional connection. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. There's not like the emotional connection to It's Hard like there was to Face Dances, which are about the same quality of album, I'd say. There's a few more hits on.
Yep.
But I think that was the biggest problem that they had. And then there was a lot of double tracking of guitars and adding chorus to it, you know? So that will really affect it as well, if that makes any sense.
It does make sense, Mike. And the other thing I guess I would ask you is, how do you feel kind of about what we're talking about? Like, because you're remixing a record that was made 30 years ago, are you trying to put yourself in a mindset of 30 years ago, or are you trying to reimagine it? Are you trying to where are you trying to come from? Which perspective?
I don't know. I mean, I think for the replacements that I think it's something that's always sort of set bad with them. So they try to fix it.
Yeah. And probably.
And I think a good, sort of similar thing happened with the Beatles on Let It Be.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great example.
And then because Paul always hated Let It Be. He couldn't stand it, right? I mean, he complained about it forever.
Right.
But then he went back and did it, and he oversaw it, and then you got the reissue Let It Be Naked.
Yep.
Now, which is awesome.
I loved it. It was cool. That's the version I listened to. And so I'm like, I'm fine with that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
And yeah. I think Let It Be Naked sounds just great.
But I don't know if he answered my question.
What's that?
I don't know if he answered my question. Like,
sorry, what was it?
When you're going to do a remix from 30 years later, are you trying to put yourself in the mindset of this is how I would have felt in 1989? Or are you trying to reimagine the record based on all the experience and history that you've absorbed in those 30 years?
If I was doing it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really wouldn't know how to answer that.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
But see, I think that's the trap, right?
Right.
That you could fall into.
That's the
trap, right? Because if you say, again, that's what I go back to, is like, okay, Don't Tell a Soul sounds like an 80s record.
Right.
Right. And Good, Bad, or Otherwise, like, and they were trying, they finally gave in and said, okay, let's do it your way, Sire Records, and let's give it a try.
Yeah. And they printed 250,000 copies in the 80s.
Right.
So they said, this is it.
Yeah.
Right?
And so, you know, the, so again, it feels to me like that's a document in time.
Yeah.
And it says something about where the band was at that time.
Yep.
And and so now to go back and remix it in 2019, are you using those modern sensibilities,
right? That's the question.
And all of that, and knowing it, and trying to pay some kind of fan service too, knowing what the fans want,
of course. Yeah,
you know, all these years later,
your place,
you know,
in history, all that.
Yeah. And one last thing I want to say on this too. I have no problem with the band, wanting to put some product out there for the fans and earn more money.
Yeah.
That's fine. Go ahead and do it.
They've earned it.
And it's not like you can't still go out and get the original versions.
Right.
It's not like
Correct.
It replaces it. It's not like a George Lucas thing
like
where he wants to...
50 cents at CD seller.
You know, where George Lucas wants to keep messing with the original Star Wars movies.
Right.
And then pretend like the original ones didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Like you can't even get those anymore. Right. Like that,
the fans never forget that.
That's right. It's not like that. But... So I don't begrudge them for doing it. And there's extra stuff on there. And there's some cool stuff. There's a live concert on the box set. There's
good.
There's the Bearsville
really good.
Stuff. There's some extra tracks. All that's fine. Go ahead. Do it. Make the money.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, pretty much any musician like that who didn't get a great chance the first time around, you know, grab it. That's all fine. It's just not for me. It's just, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of a purist with this stuff. I like to hear... I'm also not a fan, to be honest with you, of like when other, you know, artists will like remix, you know how they'll do these like, you know, celebrity remixes of things, you know,
I don't like that either.
When we interviewed Butch Vig, that's what, kind of how he got to start as a producer.
That's
remember, he was like doing YouTube remixes and stuff like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
I have no interest in that. I know sometimes with like pop stars, they'll do it for like longer versions for like, clubs.
That's right.
You know,
yeah,
and I
exactly.
get that. It's a certain utility with that, but it's not for me. I kind of like the idea of it. Like it's a single version. This is it.
That's
right. This is the song.
Yeah. And we spent a lot of money, you know, I've never said this to anyone in public, but we spent a lot of money as Wingtip Slow paying that guy from Simple Minds to remix our single. And it was a bad idea. Stupid idea.
Yeah.
Wasted a lot of money.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, Patrick, I think in the Replacements situation is they did it for the fans because they wanted to get back to that original sound, and they let somebody else do it, and they pretty much stayed out of it, right?
Yeah.
I think in the Paul McCartney situation, he did it because he wanted to go back and do what he originally thought, and it because of things at that time, he wanted to do it.
Right.
Now, I was thinking while Jim was talking, it was sort of, I agree with him, but like, I know like for me, if you ask me, would I like to go back and do it all over again? I would, because I'd be better at it. Cause it was the first time. Okay.
That's a great point. Yeah. That's
you know,
a really
it's
good
like,
point.
I didn't know what I was doing. And I would give anything if I could have afforded somebody who was really good at what they're doing. I don't think I was the best at it.
Right.
I think it was crappy.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, craftsmanship.
But if
and skill.
If I could go back and do it, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, luckily, people tell me all the time. They're like, "Oh my god, that record sounded so good." I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" You know what I mean?
Well, that's the other part of it is you always hear the things that you would change.
Yeah,
when you do it when you're involved. But I got to say, Mike, you've opened up a can of worms here that could go on for years. So this is really going to be interesting. Yeah, a lot of worms.
So one other thing I thought was interesting about like how the Beatles did it was that they went back and everybody knows they did Sgt. Pepper, mm-hmm. then they did the White Album, and then they did Abbey Road, right?
Yeah.
But what was interesting about Sgt. Pepper, and I think I remember talking to Jim or some discussion we had, you didn't like the Sgt. Pepper mixes either, did you?
I don't,
Jim.
No, that wasn't me. I don't know that I've heard that, to be honest with you.
Mike, if I recall, I think we were talking about that because I think I remember that we had been discussing the White Album, and I made a comment saying, "Wow, I really enjoyed the way the White Album was remixed."
That's right.
In the last year,
Yeah.
I thought the opening track back in the USSR, the 2018 version, was really well done. I felt like I could actually hear the vocals this time. I loved it.
Totally.
But it's interesting you mentioned that because one album I do have back at home is the Sgt. Pepper's remaster that was done in 20, I'm blanking on the year. Was it 2017?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it was 2017.
Right.
I have the 2017 remaster.
Yeah, the Giles Martin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But
wait. The remaster or the whole remixing?
It's the remixing. I'm sorry. Yeah, I forgot there's a difference. It's the remixing. But it's interesting, right? Because there's one song on there. It's She's Leaving, that song. They've sped it up on the record.
Yeah.
And one night I was playing it. My brother has the original master recording of that record. And he comes into my room and he goes, he says, "What's wrong with your track?" And I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Come here and listen to this." And I listen and I go, "Oh, that's not good. How did that happen?"
Right. I'm disowning you, brother.
So what had happened was when they did if you listen to Jeff Emmerich and those guys about Sgt. Pepper, they spent a lot of time doing the mono mix.
Oh, okay.
And the stereo mix was the afterthought.
Gotcha.
And the mono mix was hard to get here. I mean, you can get it, but you have to. I mean, I live with the stereo mix, and it's probably been a big mistake for many years.
Well, that's a good point too, Mike. I think that, you know, just like we were talking about with the era, it was like you mixed it for the most popular format.
Yeah.
At that point. If it was mono that people were listening to, that's what we mix it for.
And going back to Jim's
about
point.
Making money. Wait, what a minute. What did I say?
But but it's interesting, right? Because going back to Jim's point a while ago where you were saying, "Oh, I don't know if I would like that because it's like it's a moment in time."
Yeah.
I was talking to my dad about it. He said, "Why would I want to listen to the new ones? That's I like it the way it originally came out."
Hey Sam, on which one? On Pepper?
Actually the White Album. He said it on one. Yeah.
Mr. Lisker coming up big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also like in the case of the Beatles, especially their earlier albums, you know, just give me the mono.
Sure.
Like that's how it was originally recorded and released. I'm fine with that. I don't, you know.
Totally.
One thing they did on the Pepper that was really, really great was because it was all 4-track, right?
Yeah.
So what they did is they would go back because they would record 3 tracks, right? And then they would bounce that down to the 4th one, right? And then they open up another track and then they move it. So what they would do is they would go back to the original 3 and they would make those, and you know, now you're lining them up in, you know, however many tracks they had on the board, you know, 96 or whatever it is. And then, so they had the original 3 tracks, so they didn't lose anything when they did the bouncing.
Oh, wow.
Right. That's one of the reasons why the Pepper sounds, in my view, really, really good.
Interesting.
Yep.
And I don't think they did it as much, like on Abbey, I listened to Abbey Road this weekend again. It's like, it's definitely different, but it's not the, because it was 8 tracks, and recorded on a newer board.
Yeah.
So it still has that Abbey Road had a certain feel to it, like the other albums didn't.
Now you're getting into a whole other thing, which is technology, right?
Yeah.
So like with modern technology, could you do what maybe the band would have liked to do at the time but couldn't?
Wait, is this an episode of Black Mirror?
So, that's a whole other hour-long discussion.
I just want to say two things. One is for a long time, would only accept quadraphonic records. That's the only thing I would buy.
I know,
right?
People heard about it.
Yes,
in Toledo.
That's right. Oh, I had the largest collection of quadraphonic albums, which was like 3. I think. Yeah,
had them all.
Had
all of them.
I've only listened to this one.
That's right. Actually, I did have an uncle who had a quadraphonic stereo.
Oh,
he was
really?
The only person I think knew
cool.
who had that.
That's
that didn't
sweet.
Take off.
No,
it
never worked.
But more important than that, I want to thank you, Mike, for confusing me with young Sam Lisker earlier in the conversation.
He's no longer a patron.
Okay. All right.
Hey, I got to go. See you. No. So I want to ask you guys one more thing about Don't Tell the Soul real quick.
Sure.
What I was thinking of was one of the things I thought was kind of bad on Don't Tell the Soul was the song choice, right? Because the extra songs that were on there... It's like some of them, like,
yeah.
they were like, you know what I mean? It's like some of them were like really, really fun. And I think it would have made the album a lot more enjoyable because like I love Date to Church. I think that is just a fun, great track. Been so much better than say Back to Back or something, you know, sort of the one that's a more standard song. Mm-hmm. And you know, and sometimes I wonder people like aren't really like complaining about the mix was a stand-in for complaining about the songs, you know.
Good
what
point.
I'm saying, 'cause like,
yeah, that's a really,
you know,
good
what I mean?
Point. Yep,
I think that's really a point. The reality is top to bottom it's not as strong of an album.
Yeah. Well, that,
no, I mean the
yeah.
songs are not as good as the songs on Don't Tell the Soul are not as good as Pleased to Meet Me,
no.
or Tim, mm-hmm. or Let It Be. It's, right. not, it's not even really that close, right?
Yep.
I mean, there's some, don't get me wrong. I mean, like, I think, you know, Aching to Be,
yeah.
it's like, I don't know. It's like, that's the song that launched that whole Wilco thing. So if Echo Park Jimmy wants to get mad at that Wilco. You know,
well, I don't know. It's almost like a Chewy Foot versus If Only for the Hatchery argument. You know? Yeah, when you get down to it. And I would say thank you to Mike, you know, officially on air for being there at the Kid Brother event, you know, that we just heard. It was so fun
time.
Hanging out with Mike. And Jim, I have to say this, Mike Wagner has been Jimmy's Old Town Tavern
yeah.
in Herndon. So that was pretty sweet. It's a Buffalo bar, Jim.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mike, Sam.
Which has nothing to do with anything.
No, it doesn't. But if you want to watch the Sabres, Sam, I know where we can go.
None of us are from Buffalo. No. Right? But it's a local institution there in Herndon, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
man,
just down the street from
Wilson.
Hopping
place, man.
Oh, man. It was so packed. We yeah. could barely get in there. It was great to hang out there with Mike, though. That was fun. Man.
We had a good time.
But I'm sure we'll see you again because, yep. as mentioned at the top of the episode here, you you have a daughter who's going to college out in this area. So.
That's right.
That forces you to come out here and,
yeah.
and say hi.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to mean Mike and I are overdubbing on our triple album that we're putting together. It's a,
excited.
It's an interpretation of Buffalo Classics.
All right.
Yeah, so it's going to be good. We just haven't written them yet. We are working on music.
And then one last thing. As we record this, we do not know who the Washington Nationals,
we do not,
the mighty Washington Nationals,
that's
will
right.
face in mm-hmm. the World Series.
We do not yet.
As you listen to this, you will know that, and in fact, you may even know who won, depending on when this
yeah.
drops. But it could be the Houston Astros.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah, I hope it is. It's...
Totally, man. We only mean to beat your ass gently. We don't mean to kill you. Thank you, Mike.
We'll see how that goes.
It's awesome yeah. to hear from you, man, and we love you. You've
yep.
been there from the beginning.
Yep.
So.
Great. Oh man, it's like, you know, as I told you guys, like everybody appreciates the community you guys built, and it's great. I think we all enjoy it.
And you're a big part of it.
So speaking of the community, if anyone wants to weigh in on this topic of remixes,
yeah.
You can do that by calling, right, Sam?
Right, 612-440-1984.
Sam Whoa! Knows the whole number.
I know, right?
I just passed out.
Patrick doesn't know the whole number.
EPJ just had his own contact.
Yeah, I know there's a five in it.
All right, very good. Or email.
rock@suburbspod.com.
Very good. Or what social medias?
Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
There you go. And those, what's the handle on those?
Suburbs Pod.
Are you yeah. throwing him treats when he does that or something?
Yes, I actually have a huge stack next to me right now.
He's throwing us treats, like little fishes. Yeah.
All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foss.
And I'm intern Sam.
And thank you very much, Mike Wagner, for joining us.
Thanks, brother.
Oh, you're very welcome. And anybody, like, if you want to go out and listen to how I mix the album and tell me how bad I screwed it up, you're welcome to do so.
The name of the band again is?
Total Strangers.
Yeah.
And the name of the album is called Lost in a Crowd.
Check it out. All right.
And I kind of did that thing. I did that sort of thing like where you kind of weave in and out of songs. I like that too. So that's why it took so long.
Sweet.
And let us know when you have the quadraphonic mix available. All right.
Yeah. Then Jim will deign to listen to it.
All right.
All right, gents. That was great.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
And we'll talk to everyone later.
Rock in the Suburbs, Houston office. How may I direct your call?